Hello and welcome to the Dietitian Mindset Podcast. I am your host, Jesse McGinley, a registered dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition. The intention of this podcast is to cultivate more conversation and awareness around the field of nutrition and dietetics to elevate the profession as a whole. Conversations will not only be surrounded around the progression of dietetics, but also the mindset shift that occurs with behavior change, how to evolve as a professional within the sports world, how to collaborate amongst an interdisciplinary team, and approaches, perspectives, and research from others in the field. I hope as listeners, you leave each conversation inspired and open to a new perspective. And with that being said, enjoy today's episode. Welcome to another episode of the Dietitian Mindset Podcast. I am with Tony, an athletic trainer and physical therapist. Wide range of variety of sports that he's worked with, so I'll kind of let him kind of dive into the background, but super excited to have you on, Tony, and super excited for the conversation. So
yeah, thanks for having me on, Jesse. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tony, kind of start with your background and kind of I alluded to your experience because it's so vast and great. So let's talk about that. Let's dive in that first.
Yeah. So initially, I kind of got into the field of athletic training when I was an undergrad up at Oregon in Eugene, just getting exposure to like club sports and collegiate sports up there. And then I ended up kind of focusing and doing some shadowing in, you know, Oregon football, women's softball, women's lacrosse and soccer as well. And then, you know, once I got the feel for that athletic training field, I wanted to go get my master's in it. So I went out to University of Arkansas, and that's where I ended up going to like AT school, getting the master's degree from there. And then, you know, each semester you had to do your different rotations with different sports. So my very first rotation was with Arkansas football. So D1 just kind of hit the ground running, so to speak. And then, you know, after that, it slowed way down with transitioning to women's volleyball at the D1 level. So going from, you know, 120 football players to only like 11 volleyball players was a pretty nice transition.
Right.
And then, you know, in between there, I went up to Seattle with the Seahawks to do a training camp internship with the sports medicine staff up there. So that was like 6.5 weeks roughly in my summer between my first and second year. Went back to school, worked with a kind of a low income high school in Springdale, Arkansas. So that was a pretty neat experience, just kind of having to cover football, volleyball, soccer. And then wrestling kind of came in at the end of the semester there. So just kind of having to deal with a little bit of everything. And then, you know, my last semester in AT school, I worked with men's track and field at Arkansas. So pretty elite D1 cross country track and field athletes. And then after that, I ended up going back to Seattle it was basically a seasonal internship for 2 years doing, just being an athletic trainer up there with them. Spent a couple seasons up there in 2018 and 2019. And then that kind of came to a weird abrupt end just with COVID. Like I was nearing my end there, and like, you know, we had mini camps and things that were coming up in my last kind of spring there, but then everything closed in March. So like I kind of came to an abrupt end. And then like a couple months before that, I ended up deciding to go back to PT school. Just, I saw there was like a trend in professional sports and high level sports to have like your PT and your AT degrees. So, sure. So that's why I applied back to PT school, and then ultimately ended up here in Colorado. Like getting into PT, I worked like different sort of rotations here between acute care, like in the hospital setting, and just your regular outpatient orthopedics. And then I actually had a really cool experience. My last 4 months of PT school, I went down to Exos, one of their performance facilities in Florida. So I worked directly with a lot of the, you know, some of the guys that were rehabbing some injuries and some of the free agents that were down there. But our main population was like high level military personnel.
Interesting.
So yeah, it was called like an active return to duty program. So guys from all over the world in different branches of the military would come to Pensacola, Florida, basically, and they would spend either 4 or 8 weeks just doing performance training, physical therapy, focusing on nutrition, and just getting their bodies right to like go back to their assignments, whether it was overseas or in the country. So it was super cool.
Yeah, no, there's so many parallels with like combat nutrition and like combat therapy and training and all of those things with
our military with sports. So that's awesome that you kind of got to add that to the toolbox.
Yeah, it was definitely a great and fun way to end PT school. And I've never lived at the beach before, so that was pretty fun too.
Nice. Yeah, Pensacola is not a bad area.
Yeah, not a bad area at all. But I'm good on the hurricane dangers. I'll skip that one.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, kind of going back, I mean, like so many sports and so many experiences, what was the most like impactful for your kind of, like I said, gaining tools in your toolbox, or what was the most like pivotal experience that you've had?
Oh man, there's a couple that I could pull from. I mean, I think the one from, you know, working both like Oregon football, even not as like an athletic training student per se, but I was still like an intern with them. So like, you know, seeing that sort of level of collaboration with ATs, with docs, with nutritionists, with strength conditioning staff, like that was my kind of first exposure to what like collaborative medicine looks like for collegiate athletes. So that was I feel like that was the rope that I kind of grabbed onto to pull me into that sort of field in general. And then, you know, I saw it operate a little bit differently from a functional standpoint with Arkansas and their football team, but still collaborative in nature. And then it became more prevalent both when I was in Seattle in the NFL and when I was down at Exos, just like seeing how much collaboration goes into like making somebody either maintain their health or recover from those acute or long-term injuries. And that's kind of why I like to do what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting talking even with like football RDs or football strength coaches, like everything, it's all kind of like the foundations are there, but operationally it can look different from place to place.
For sure.
So it's interesting from a athletic training standpoint that it was also similar in terms of flexibility. So what are your thoughts? You kind of, again, just hit on it, but like, what are your thoughts on like the holistic approach and care and your experience with, can you dive in a little bit more with the collaboration, like with the interdisciplinary team? Like, what did that look like?
Yeah. So anytime there were, you know, anytime you come up with like an injury report, right? We'll kind of stick with football here for a second, but you know, anytime an injury pops up on the injury report, it's all about A, understanding what the injury is. So like, you know, the luxury of being at higher level athletics is your ability to get imaging a little bit faster, right? Your ability to understand what's kind of happening at that physiological level. So then it turns into, okay, we're dealing with somebody who's got like a grade 2 hamstring strain. We need to get them on X protocol to, you know, start with the early rehab phase. But what else does that include other than just like the rehab medicine side of it, right? So there's other things, especially from a nutrition standpoint, and there's other ways to integrate the strength conditioning staff to still keep those guys involved or the athletes involved in with their team, with their physical fitness, and with, you know, meeting their needs from a nutrition standpoint to help kind of increase their likelihood of coming back from that injury a little bit faster than sure. what the average timeline might say, right? So it's trying to throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and really see what sticks when you have the luxury to do it. That's honestly how I feel about it. And it's great because yeah. a lot of times a lot of things do stick and it works well for athletes.
Yeah. No, I love that analogy because it's so accurate. And I think the different approaches and the more people that are there kind of reinforcing the overall message is what helps it stick, essentially, from my experience, at least.
Yeah, but, for sure.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so you think about the like the preventative side of things too, right? It's like all your athletes who come in, they can get all the screens done from the movement standpoint, but then you do like your metabolic panels, your CBCs, and like get all of those baseline levels, you know, looking at like vitamin D and things like that, that have been a little bit more heavily researched, so to speak, especially in college settings for like your bone stress injuries and your injury prevalence in general. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And like, what is your experience? I know just historically from my perspective, I mean, sports nutrition is like relatively new in the sense of like integration. And when I say new, I mean like 10, 20 years, as opposed to like athletic trainers and strength coaches being around for much longer. What is your experience with like clear defined roles and messaging and conversations kind of within the interdisciplinary team? Like any, I guess, what would enhance collaboration or what would impact collaboration from that angle?
I think it's, I feel like everybody has their own little stance on this, so I might have my own view on this, but I think when it comes to making like a truly successful kind of collaborative team, I feel like mainly the strength and conditioning staffs and the athletic training staffs or sports med staffs, like some people need to like take a slice of humble pie and just take a bite of it. And I say that in the nicest way possible, because I feel like there's a lot of times where AT, like athletic trainers, feel like they're supposed to know a lot of different things to like help their athletes. So they kind of have this pressure to kind of give them everything because they're so readily available for the athletes. Right. And, you know, we get basic nutrition education, you know, the simple things relative to hydration and just like your basic protein intake. But like, if you want to get into the nitty gritty of like nutrition and how it's involved in, you know, injury repair and like, you know, injury risk reduction and things like that. Like for me, I want to let the experts do what they do. And it's the same thing that it's the same approach that I have with like strength conditioning specialists, right? Like there's that gray zone between what's rehab and what's performance training, right? So
absolutely,
when I get to a point where I feel comfortable, you know, with everything that I've done with my athlete from a range of motion, a pain reduction standpoint, and a basic foundational movement standpoint, people go get their master's degrees and they go get all this experience, whether it's paid or unpaid, right? Mm-hmm. They go get all this experience to use to know how to get somebody stronger in weeks or months in time, right? Or even quickly. And then those same people who can specialize in that like sports specific return to practice type things that, you know, athletic trainers feel like they have to know it. And in some situations they do have to implement it. But in situations like in the NFL and Division I collegiate sports, like they should utilize their resources around them so their shoulders aren't weighed down so much by all that responsibility, because there's a lot of other things they have to take care of too.
Yeah, no, I feel for athletic trainers because the caseload and the hours and all of the, I think just responsibility is the best word to put it, like the best way to put it. Like there is a ton and so many random things pop up that needs to be fixed like on a daily basis, whether it's fun for, you know, like a fun rehab case. And I mean, fun relatively, but more of a complex case that actually like challenges you and is at a higher level as opposed to like something that may not be as fun. And it's just, you know, on a lesser level, but it still pops up and it's still kind of there. In terms of like sharing caseload. So in an ideal world, I mean, obviously we have enough athletic trainers and dietitians and everything, if we're speaking on a football terms, to kind of manage like 150 players and even more, you know, at various levels. So when, let's just from a nutrition standpoint, when a dietitian is not necessarily traveling with a team or can't do all of the nutrition implications that are there and just have to prioritize, how would you suggest them kind of sharing that like education dissemination with that team or population that they're working with using the strength and conditioning and athletic trainers in the right way?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can kind of start with being open to, you know, an in-service type of presentation. Like, I think you as the dietitian being able to like have your platform and present to the strength coaches and the athletic trainers, both on, you know, what are the nutritional demands from the athlete, like for the duration of a football game or for the duration of a 10K, like whatever sport you're in, right? Like,
sure.
You can share your expertise on what basic foundational demands are from a nutritional standpoint. And, you know, if you're kind of going back into the football realm, like you're talking packing for road games, right? Whether it's just a certain amount of like Gatorade or Powerade or whatever sort of electrolyte drink like the athletes need, you know, just making sure that we try to meet minimums for the guys who are playing 35, 40 minutes of the game or 60 minutes, whatever it may be. Like, everybody needs to be on board to kind of share that ability to give the athletes the nutrients they need if there's only, you know, if there's no dietitian able to come on the road, right? And even if there is, you still got to be able to share and help out like in game. There's so much stuff going on, but at the end of the day, so, like you just you have to make sure that your athlete could still stay on the field without having to come off because of exercise-induced fatigue or muscle cramps, right? And there's just things that you want to try to avoid. And, you know, you got to do your part from the things you can control, which is things like nutrition and all that sort of stuff to help reduce that risk of like missed playing time.
Right. Right. I think the in-game nutrition has definitely drastically changed, at least at the football level, you know, in the last 10, 15 years. I think even we're seeing that kind of shift in basketball culture and all of those things. Like it's starting to trickle into other sports in regard to what we can do in game. And then also kind of sharing that anyone can pass out gummies and anyone can like pass out Powerade, but it's also that level of respect and the boundaries of like, what is the role and how deep can we go here? So I think that's important.
And I think you just hit it right there too. It's like anybody can do like the gummies and the easy like Gatorade and stuff, but it takes that kind of collaborative effort to like really get personalized nutrition, right? If you talk about like your preseason training and looking at like individual sweat rates, like some people's sweat rates may be substantially higher than others, right? Your offensive linemen usually have those higher sweat rates. Just that's kind of just how it works for them. So they might need a little bit more like customized nutrition at halftime, third and fourth quarter compared to, you know, your linebacker or your defensive back or, you know, whatever other position. Everybody's got a little bit different demands. So I think that's where you get fun with it too. And like, make sure you can be as personal as you can with those guys who are getting more reps to make sure everybody's taken care of on a general level and on a, like a personal level too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also like the knowledge that it's more than just handing out gummies, you know, it kind of just hitting it on the head right there with the individualized and everyone's kind of moving to just a higher level of care and kind of like switching back to like your experience with like being an athletic trainer or in a physical therapist realm. Like how do you approach different populations? And you have so much experience with so many different populations. How do you tailor your approach when working, you know, with Oregon football or Arkansas football versus Arkansas volleyball or the military kind of population at Exos? Like, how do you tailor that?
Yeah, I think you just have to think about it from like a movement demand standpoint. Everybody's requirements are a little bit different, right? There's, you know, from a foundational standpoint, most sports are like change of direction. Most sports are a little bit longer in duration. You get a little bit, more specific with like your track and field, right? 60 meter hurdles is much different than your 10K. Right. So like in PT clinics, when you have, you know, your different kind of athletes come in, whether they're your recreational 5K athletes or your CrossFit athletes versus your, you know, your marathoners and your Ironman athletes, I think you just have to understand what the demand is from a movement standpoint and then think about what things like strength conditioning principles are going to be applicable to them and like what nutrition principles would be applicable to them. And then, you know, kind of start that conversation and see what their understanding is of their own demands. And then if you feel like they have a need for further education, then, you know, I can provide my own basic level of expertise and then offer like, say, hey, I have this RD here in Denver that specializes in distance athletes. So I think that would be a good place for you to start to help try to maintain your level of fitness and to even improve your ability for performance too. And it's the same thing with strength coaches too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that like opening the door of, hey, this is what I recommend, but to go deeper, we can use this resource, you know, in every facet of performance. What has been, I mean, in this space, regardless of title, regardless of role, we all hear the myths or the TikTok recommendations or anything. What is the most wild, like, hey, I heard that if I do this movement or if I do this nutrition recommendation, like, what are your thoughts on this? Like, what is the biggest red flag that you've been like, oh my goodness, if any?
I think, you know, I had a kid last year come up to me and he was, I don't know how viral this went because I never personally saw it. So I'm just going off of what he told me, but He was a kid who had been dealing with multiple concussions. Mm-hmm. And apparently he went down the rabbit hole of YouTube and social media, and he thought his big toe mobility had to do with his concussion risk. So that was a jaw-dropping moment, just like you had there. It was pretty bad. So I kind of had to tell him, because he was kind of convinced of that it was true. And I was like, you know what? We can work on your big toe mobility. I can show you some things to do, but I can tell you right now, from everything that's out there, there is nothing that shows us that your big toe mobility helps decrease your risk for concussions. And then just
that,
having an app.
That is pretty wild.
Yeah, it's bizarre. But yeah, there's some weird things out there.
Weird things. And I mean, kind of going, like, what is your approach in terms of like taking something so out there and kind of helping this person understand, or getting them to the like actual like root of like kind of debunking the myths? Like how would you go about doing that? And that's kind of universal, but.
Yeah. So I think I like to make the person kind of re-explain the story of how they got hurt, and then mm-hmm. tie it back into like movement principles, right? You know, like, say you have a hamstring strain, or like even we can dive into like the concussion thing too. Usually concussions are from like direct contact or some sort of impact, some sort of rapid deceleration, acceleration mechanism, that coup, counter coup mechanism, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so I just like to make them retell the story and then just tie it back into those basic movement principles. And I learned a lot, and it's an easy way to explain to people, like from a movement standpoint, we have to figure out, we either have to absorb force from the ground, or we have to produce it back into the ground to create movement, right? So foundationally, we require certain motions and certain mobility things at every part of our body, whether it's from the foot, the knee, the hip, whatever it may be, to make sure we move correctly. And then that's how I kind of tie back in like what I want to get into from a therapy standpoint.
Right. And it's the retelling of the story, whether it's a movement foundation or a nutrition like myth, just like, okay, explain to me what your thought process is behind this. And then let's, as someone in retells the story, it's kind of almost like it's like making connections that like, mm-hmm. Wait a second. Like now hearing it out loud, I'm kind of debunking myself a little bit.
Yeah,
and then really filtering in that education standpoint of like, hey, see how there's some holes in this story. Let's fill the gaps a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of on that same note, like, what is your experience working with athletes? I mean, it happens so often in this population just because we're high achieving and typically type A and all of these things, and kind of that perfectionist model, because you kind of have to be at a high level with athletics. But what is your experience with shifting the mindset surrounding injury and recovery, and if somebody's not meeting their milestones? What is your experience and thoughts on that?
Yeah, so especially with like those, I mean, whether it's your acute soft tissue injuries or your surgical long-term injuries, I always kind of set the expectation, and I give the athletes education, like, your doctor handed you a piece of paper and it just has a timeline on it. That doesn't mean you're going to fit into that timeline. Sometimes it may be a little bit sooner. Sometimes it may be after. There's things that we can control that we are going to do our part, and you're going to do your part to make sure that we can, you know, nix all those variables out to like play a role into your ability to come back from your injury. But there are some times where you can't control some things that happen. And, you know, setting that expectation for them that it might not be perfect is, I think it's an appropriate way to start. That way, when there are bumps in the road, you can kind of show the athlete, okay, this is where we're at. You know, you can step back, reevaluate things with them, and then make little changes to their approach to rehab, right?
Right. Yeah. It's always so tough when someone's handed a piece of paper with a finite recovery time, or honestly, anything. If given mm-hmm. a finite result, or making it outcome resulted kind of orientation, it's really right. hard to kind of be like, no, this is actually a range. This is a wide range based on a lot of different factors, even if we want to even boil it down to genetics, like even boil down to like a cellular physiological level. Like there's just some things you can't control. And the timeline is going to be very different. And based on like adherence to recovery and acceptance and your body's take on all of it. Like it's all very individual. So like, how do you have those conversations with doctors or with physicians that kind of give that, or like if given just like recovery is 6 months, point blank period, like how do you just kind of build off that and be like, actually it's, you know, it can be anywhere from 5 to 10 months, or, you know, how do you, like, what is your phrase that you use to kind of gently educate coaches, players, physicians, all of the above?
Yeah. So I think like with physicians in particular, right, they, you know, and it really does depend on the physician, right? If you're talking to a primary care versus an orthopedic, that conversation looks a little bit different. And, you know, where I'm at right now, like a lot of times I do get, you know, those timeframes from primary care physicians, and it is a little bit frustrating. So I kind of have to have conversations with them, especially when the timeline isn't met. Like I'll have a conversation with someone and say, hey, you know, they, like this patient didn't start physical therapy for even 6 weeks when they could have been in the first week. So like, you know, I don't know what you do with your patients normally after, you know, a total knee. Like some patients are told to wait a month for PT. Some patients are told not even to do PT at all, which is like incredible to me. But so just kind of educating those physicians who like don't really specialize in that sort of realm on like what outcomes look like when, you know, therapy is initiated a little bit earlier, or, you know, what, how people can improve their function in a shorter time frame if they get to starting with easy quad sets and knee extensions in the first week or two of ACL rehab, right? So just, you know, providing that education on a foundational level without trying to like step on their toes and like insult them, it can be a challenging conversation to have too.
Yeah, I think in multiple different disciplines, you can have that, you know, like that crossover, kind of like what we like were talking a little earlier on, the gray area between rehab versus strength conditioning and all of those things. So I could see the gray area for sure. And then kind of speaking from an outcome standpoint, have you seen, I mean, from kind of tying in all the holistic approaches and all of those things, like, do you see, and research can kind of back this, so I'm kind of just like teeing you up for this one, but like when an athlete or an individual kind of ties in everything holistically, can you talk about like the importance of that in regard to mobility or adherent, like just outcomes in general?
Yeah, I mean, all the research will show you that outcomes are definitely improved from a, you know, whether it's acute return to play or like a more prolonged, like athlete satisfaction sort of survey, right? Or 2 years post-op function, like more collaborative approach between that strength conditioning and nutrition staff and that sports performance staff, like the athletes are ultimately going to be better off in the long run. And I think it does, you know, it does start from the beginning and getting everybody involved in the beginning, right? Making sure your athlete is getting the appropriate caloric intake, the appropriate nutrients from a protein, a collagen, a variety of vitamin standpoint to come back and manage their bone bruise, their ACL tear, their hamstring strain, their, you know, whatever surgery you can think of, right? There's so many components that go into that acute healing phase and the chronic healing phases for the body. And then you tie strength conditioning staff in the beginning too, and like kind of bringing it back to that athlete participation, right? There, you know, the phenomenon is like the cross training effect, right? So if you can't use one limb, you say you have a broken leg, you got a big old cast on, you can still do single leg strength training on the other side and still get benefits to the leg you're not even using. So like giving that sort of education and then letting the strength staff take the reins there and say, hey, this person can still do all upper body push pull. They can do a single leg rowing exercise. They can get on the Aerodyne and do, you know, use all or two arms and one leg and still do sprints and that sort of stuff. Right. And then you even get into the non like rehab side of things too. Like these players, like still let them go to meetings, like let them watch film, let them be involved in their sport, and everything from that collaborative standpoint will make that rehab phase for those athletes just way better.
Yeah, I think there's a huge, I mean, this is also like a growing field, but the sports psychology side of rehab and nutrition and behavior change and all of that is so needed, especially if we're talking long-term or even, you know, even in the short-term space. But when it's something is months and consistency is important and all of those things, I think the sports psychology aspect is huge. And as long as like everyone is aware of that referral system with return to play and all of that, it's interesting to see more of sports psychology be written into the return to play or all of that just because of the psychological impacts there. But yeah, no, that's awesome. I think the last little question is what, if anything, that you magic wand, or like, if you could talk to everybody in this space, like, anything that you wish was talked about more in your field or kind of debunked in your field from regardless of discipline or regardless of like area that you kind of see, is there anything that you, yeah, is there anything that you would say or wish would, was more talked about?
I think like, I mean, there's such a drive to improve the outcomes from like your acute soft tissue injuries, right? Your acute ankle sprains, your acute quad strains, hip flexor strains, muscle strains in general. Like there's such a phenomena to, you know, really get back to these fast. And I think one real big area that is still, I feel like it's still confusing for people, is whether to use ice or not, right? It's such a classic thing that it's been instilled for decades and decades to, as soon as you roll your ankle, put some ice on it. As soon as you pull your muscle, put some ice on it. And, you know, I mean, in our fields in particular, I think we know this, but for the general population, they don't know this. A lot of people will get hurt and they'll just ice and take an Advil, right? Or ice and anti-inflammatory of some sort. And mm-hmm. You know, I think we all need to do a better job at educating just the general public on, you know what, hey, the doctor who coined rice actually debunked his own theory like 8 years ago. And not a lot of people know that. So I always like to sprinkle that in with my patients who have those soft tissue injuries and be like, hey, I know you've been icing 4 or 5 times a day ever since you hurt your injury, but you actually might be prolonging your healing by doing that. And so, you know, being able to give that sort of education, and then, you know, I think in the acute sports world, you have to have a good balance of it, right? Because, mm-hmm. You know, whenever you have that initial injury, everybody who loves to ice will say, oh, I want to manage their pain and I want to decrease secondary hypoxic injury, things like that. And to that, like you say, you have to look at like what the athlete believes in too. Because there's always a place and time to do it. I'm not saying I would never ice with an athlete after a real acute injury.
Right.
But if somebody believes it, I mean, I'm not going to say no to it. But I think it's important to kind of dive into a little bit more of what the research says from that standpoint. And then allowing your nutritionist to get involved. Say, hey, we have these things that we can really add to your daily diet, whether it's increasing your omega intake or your healthy fat intake to help moderate some of that inflammation, right? Or some of your, you know, maybe add a little bit more berries into your life and get some antioxidant mm-hmm. help and things like that. So, but then
right. Obviously
you hand off and like let you take over and let your RDs take over and really take over that acute injury management from the nutrition standpoint.
Right. Because it's, even just touching on that on a little bit, like people can say more omega-3s or more antioxidants or anything like that, but don't understand it's a full picture of what a day looks like, what a week looks like.
Right.
And so there's a lot more planning that goes into it as opposed to the general information. So that's like that deeper information. If you don't mind, like kind of going into the debunking the ice thing, like why is that not a thing? Or what does the research say for people that aren't aware?
Yeah. So with ice in particular, right, you talk about what does ice do from a foundational standpoint. Ice will lead to a little bit of vasoconstriction, decreasing blood flow, decreased swelling, technically decreasing pain, of course, by decreasing like the neurotransmission, so to speak, of pain signals. And, you know, all of those can combine to just help minimize any swelling in the area. But you know, that first, you know, some people say the first 48 hours, some people say 72, some people even say up to 5 days, depending on what you read. But those first few days of that inflammatory response, like, our body is trying to signal all of the healthy inflammatory mediators to get there, right? Start the tissue repair process, start getting rid of the tissue that is injured that we can just totally get rid of, and then start rebuilding that foundational muscle fiber, the ligament, so to speak, like any, whatever injured tissue there is there. Like, we're trying to start that process, and we're not trying to delay it. And, you know, some of the research has shown, like, there's just a little bit of a delay in our body's natural healing process if we constantly restrict the blood flow to that area. So that's kind of the thought process behind it.
Right. Because every other, I mean, I'm not in this space at all, but any other like recovery modality, like dry needling or cupping or stem or anything like that, is creating that minor inflammatory response, correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you dive into like your dry needlings, right? I mean, dry needling can help like with releasing some of those like local trigger points to some soft tissue injuries. And then dry needling will like help increase that blood flow to help get some of those inflammatory mediators to that injured site, bring in the oxygen, bring in some of those things that are required for actual tissue repair. And then, you know, your things like your TENS units or any of your stem units, that's kind of more like a, you mask the pain and discomfort, so to speak, right? You throw TENS on for 20 to 30 minutes and it helps manage your pain for like 2 or 3 hours. And then pain kind of comes right back because it doesn't do anything from the cellular level.
Right. So looking at it from like a much deeper level and kind of using the body's innate responses to its advantage, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, you know, feeding the body what it needs to, and then giving the body a chance to be resilient, because that's what our bodies are. We figure out ways to move, whether we are hurt or not. Our bodies are so much smarter than we think they are. And if we just give it, if we give the body all, like all individual parts to the recipe, like it'll figure it out. We will find a way to heal, right? And the recipe includes all of your nutrition components, your necessary loading components to help stimulate that tissue regeneration at the muscular level. There's things, you know, all your strength conditioning principles to help create, you know, integrate hypertrophy, strength gains, and endurance gains, things like that. So it's all right. Good.
So last little question, just a tangent off of this, but like, cryotherapy, like, what are your thoughts there?
I don't mind cryotherapy for people. I mean, if they're trying to, I guess the question off of that, is it like cryotherapy, like the chamber, or are we talking like cold tubs? Like, what are we talking about?
I think the chamber is like becoming more and more popular. So like kind of talking like about that, just because it's kind of a fad.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely that. And it has like, you know, I think it has its pros, right? I think the psychological perception of feeling kind of better, I think it's one that we can't devalue, right? And if you step into something and it totally kind of shocks the nervous system a little bit and you walk out almost feeling like refreshed, that psychological part of, you know, recovery is, it's important. Now, I'm not super familiar with a ton of the research on it, but from my understanding, from what I've read, it's like the cryo chambers, they're so cold, you can't stay in there for that long, right? You only go in there for what, like 90 seconds, or it's only like a couple minutes max.
Yeah.
And so like from what I've read, you can't change tissue temperature that deep, that fast, right? So actually creating change at that deep muscular level for somebody who walks in there and they're 330 pounds, right? It's a little bit different than sending your 110 pound cross country runner in there. So there might be different physiological effects that occur based off of somebody's body composition in general. So I don't know how well researched it is to change tissue temperature.
Yeah. I think that's important for athletes. If there's any athletes listening to hear, I think there's definitely more, the better ways to approach things. And I think talking with the experts and not going off of TikTok and all the fads going on, I think that it kind of rounds out the conversation surrounding that.
Yeah.
But yeah. But Tony, this has been awesome talking about kind of your experience and all of the different recovery modalities and collaboration. And I just appreciate your time. Appreciate your knowledge and your experience. So thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. This was definitely awesome. It's good to catch up for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. And listeners, thanks for tuning into another episode, and we will catch you next time. Thanks.